Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, May 3rd, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, Kevin Cullen and Paul Meck join us to talk about the work they're doing at Discovery World in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Part of what they're doing is using an interactive approach to bringing brewing history back to life by brewing ancient recipes. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can also find, for a limited time, our 2012 Brewer's Logbooks, where you can track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. On Facebook, I'm facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Home Brewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and the Android app is also on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too, and we're on Stitcher, the Stitcher app as well. The data form for the current Brew Your Own Magazine Basic Brewing Radio Collaborative Experiment on secondary fermenters is online and apparently working. You can find it at basicbrewing.com/experiment. As I said this past week, we already have an entry. The deadline to get your data in to me is May 21st. I've now brewed a second batch of beer as part of that experiment. I had some very interesting results from the first batch that I brewed. That was a Belgian amber. And this second batch is a hoppy pale ale to kind of stick with the rut that I've gotten myself into. It's either the Belgian amber or the pale ale lately. I got to brew something different. Anyway, I racked one of those two fermenters, primary fermenters, with the pale ale in it to secondary yesterday. Boy, it smells and tastes great, by the way. So I'll be watching to see what happens with that process, and I look forward to hearing what you are finding out as well. As you may know, we tend to take June off every year to take family vacations and to go to the Homebrewers Conference. This year, it's in Seattle, and we're really excited about that. Steve, Andy, and I have our plane tickets, and we're good to go. This year, my wife has moved up the family vacation a bit because we only had one snow day this year, so we can take off a little earlier. So the May 24th show is planned to be our last one before the break. However, we will be coming back on the air or on the internet, whatever, the week after the Homebrew Conference. So you'll only be without us for the same amount of time. So I'm saying all that because I always get email when we take off for vacation with panicked listeners saying, "Are you okay? Where's the podcast? It's Thursday morning." So just giving you some advance notice. The American Homebrewers Association's Big Brew Day is this Saturday, May 5th. The annual event is designed to celebrate National Homebrew Day. So get with your local homebrew club or a homebrew shop to see what they're doing and take part. I plan to drop in on the goings-on at the Home Brewery in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Last year, there were several batches brewed right there in front of the store. There's good news from Alabama. The Alabama House has passed a bill that would legalize home brewing in that state. The vote was 44 to 33. And the bill now goes for debate in the Alabama Senate. So congratulations to Alabama homebrewers for all the work that you did with that. And good luck in the Senate. You may need it. Contact your state senators and urge them to support legalizing homebrew in Alabama. Now, House Bill 354 would apparently allow homebrewers age 21 and up to brew up to 15 gallons of beer or wine per quarter, or about 5 gallons a month. So it's not perfect. It doesn't live up to the 200 gallons per household per year that most of the rest of the country enjoys, but it's a start. And it's better than the restrictions that some lawmakers wanted to put on homebrewers through proposed amendments to the bill. One of the proposed amendments would have required homebrewers to be at least 60 years old. And another would have required brewers to obtain a license and pay an annual $100 fee. And yet another would have limited home brewing to 15 gallons a year and made it a felony to brew more than that. So, you know, count your blessings, I guess. So good luck, you guys. The fight's not over. It's got to go through the Senate and be signed by the governor before it's legalized. Please keep me posted on the progress of the legislation going on down there. You guys are my ears and eyes. So, I'm so inundated with email and social media and such that sometimes it's hard to sift through the all the information that's coming through. So I appreciate you guys' help. Speaking of getting good stuff from listeners, good information from listeners, a little while back I got an email from Michael Henderson from Milwaukee, or at least around the Milwaukee area. He was really excited because he had attended a brewing session at Discovery World there in Milwaukee. There they brewed an ancient mead recipe. And it turns out that mead was part of an ongoing series of historic brewing sessions there at Discovery World. So I was fascinated. So I gave Kevin Cullen and Paul Meck of Discovery World a call. Well, Kevin Cullen and Paul Meck, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Glad to be here.
Now, start with you, Kevin. You're up there at Discovery World up in Milwaukee. Tell us about the museum.
Right. Well, Discovery World is an organization kind of like, not like many others that I've certainly seen in the museum world. It sort of tries to be an own museum in some ways. But if you were to categorize it, it would be a science and technology museum meets an aquarium. We're right on, built on Lake Michigan by the art museum, the Calatrava. And it's been around for 30 years, in fact, this year. It's kind of a coalescence of really where the idea of hands-on museums come together, meets the environment and innovation. And so those are the major sort of themes of the organization. So with very unique exhibits, 9 laboratories and studios, and two digital theaters, we have great conference spaces, and it's just really at the doorstep to Milwaukee, both past and present. It certainly was in the past. It was called Pier Wisconsin, where the early immigrants to Milwaukee in the 1840s would actually offload. And ironically enough, they would walk down the pier to the mainland, and there was a brewery there located. So one of the first breweries in the state of Wisconsin, in fact, was a stone's throw away from here. No longer there, but that's another story we can get into down as we move forward. But my colleague Paul Meck here runs and oversees the Thirst Lab, the MillerCoors Freshwater Thirst Lab, which is where we also have our one-barrel brewery. But I'll let Paul talk about the lab and introduce himself.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, the full name of the space is the MillerCoors Thirst Lab for Freshwater Innovation. And people know of MillerCoors as, you know, for the beer they produce, but what they don't realize is how much of a water user they are. And so they wanted people in the city of Milwaukee to have a place where they could come to experience the chemistry of water and realize what water can become firsthand. And that's what we do in the Thirst Lab, is we let the public actually experience the creation of different things that they consume all the time and actually have a hand in it the entire way. So Kevin's programs are just one small part of that. And along the way, they realized that, you know, they know what's in beer and they know how to drink beer, but they don't realize that the steps that it goes through to be made are very similar to how soda is made, or tea, or coffee, or soy sauce, or anything, whether it's fermented or not. They follow a lot of the similar paths.
So you got to start out with good water to get good beverages and good soy sauce and everything else that you talk about.
Absolutely. Start out with bad water. It doesn't matter how good your ingredients are. You're going to have bad beer or bad soda or bad whatever.
So do you actually make these things like soda and soy sauce and all the non-fermentables too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we teach people starting, we'll work with students third grade, sometimes a little younger, all the way up to adult programs that, that Kevin and I will lead, and we actually have them create these products. And with the soda, one of our things is we don't focus as much on how to force carbonate it. We look at natural carbonation and that slight fermentation that used to happen in sodas. And we teach them how to make, how soda was made by their great-grandparents.
So you guys are actually bringing history back to life.
Literally, yes. One palate at a time. So, you know, whether it's for the adult or the fourth grader, it's really the celebration of the products that we consume really daily or weekly, but also how those products play into the history of this city and certainly nationwide. And then on the broader scope, looking at things spatially and temporally, as an anthropologist and archaeologist, I try to bring that out with some of the classes with the Ale Through the Ages, certainly, where we explore over 9,000, 10,000 years of fermented history and experimental archaeology by bringing those ingredients and techniques back to life and imbibing them and enjoying kind of the broad range, the broad palette of flavors when it comes to the fermented beverages. So it really is fun to imbibe the past, you know, both today, 100 years ago, and literally, you know, as close as we can get anyway, to 10,000 years ago.
Tell me about you guys' background. I mean, are both of you guys homebrewers?
I did. I started off as in Madison, University of Wisconsin, as an undergrad in the 90s, and I started brewing there with my older brother, and then was dabbling in it on my own until really graduate school. I got serious about it in terms of the academic perspective, and that was really where my advisor in grad school, Dr. Bettina Arnold, in fact, we just did a program recently with her for Iron Age Brewing. And so she and her husband were big brewers as well, and so it was kind of fun to sort of really take what is a hobby and then make it kind of much more, I'd say, professional, certainly by doing systematic research and recreation. So that sort of spawned into, you know, really more of a more of a career in the brewing aspect than it is in the archaeology in my particular position, which is kind of fun. But to combine the two, I think, is a rare thing to find.
Yeah.
So, and for Paul, you jumped right into doing one barrel brew.
Yeah. So I actually had no homebrewing experience whatsoever. I was certainly interested in how it was done, but until I started interacting with Kevin and his program, I never actually had tried brewing beer myself. And so I started out with it just by working here and one of the programs that he was doing, and it eventually became incorporated into the space that I'm overseeing. But sometimes I'll bring in, I have a biology and a chemistry background, so you know, it helps that sometimes I can understand why the yeast might be doing something or why we get certain flavors and explain that to people. But I'm envious of Kevin for all the experience he has. And as Kevin said, yeah, I'm working from the top down. So the first time I ever tried brewing beer was on our one barrel system.
Well, that's a good place to start, I'd say.
A lot of brewers that we meet even here in this, you know, in Milwaukee start right up without any background in home brewing, and you know, they kind of work their way up in the brew house, but they start in on a 5-barrel, 10-barrel system. So, I mean, it's not that different. You're just scaling up ingredients. You're just moving a lot more words around in the end. But you know, it's getting the subtle flavors right on a small scale, and then you really can kind of extrapolate to at least, well, the 50-barrel scale if you get that big.
Tell me about your one-barrel system. What's it like?
Well, it's it Premier Stainless out of San Marcos, California, installed it. They've done a lot of brew houses around the country. They're kind of a growing company. But in fact, we because of our lab space, we only wanted a one barrel, and they were like, "Well, this is our showroom model. We don't actually make them, so they have to make a custom one barrel system." And really, what it is, it's a brew house. You know, kind of really shrunk down to one barrel. So we have two conical fermenters that can hold about a barrel and a half of fermenting beer, and there's it's an all grain system where we have it's all steam fired in a steam jacket for the brew kettle. The mash tun has a false bottom with, you know, we can get about 100 pounds of grain in there, maybe a bit more. So for the Master Brewer class, we really max it out. A lot of the head brewers from various breweries like Lakefront Brewing Company up here in Milwaukee, or Milwaukee Brewing Company, or Miller Coors, these head brewers will come in and try to really get some big octane beers out of it. So we've pulled off an 11% beer with Andy Jones from Lakefront. We did an Imperial IPA that was outstanding, and so it's fun, and we're, you know, and along the way, the participants in these classes are learning how to pump wort through the system, and sort of, you know, why it's set up the way it is. But it really is a compact system. And then, of course, we have beside that is a 15-gallon system, more of a homebrew scale, and those are the Bleichmann systems with the top tier. So we're using gravity to move wort around in that case, which is more what they'd be doing at home anyway. So we want to give them an experience of kind of moving from the partial grain recipes to the all grain and then up to the one barrel. So it's kind of a tiered system. And then who knows, after that, maybe they'll go off to Siebel Institute or wherever, San Diego, and take up a professional degree. Who knows?
Sure. So what do you have a tap room or something like that? Or what do you do with all that beer?
Well, that's actually one of the biggest problems that we've had. And it's a problem that a lot of people would probably like to have, but when you have it, it's not so much fun. As a result, we try to only brew on the large system when we know that we'll be able to get rid of it all. We can give it away as part of the class, and we can give it as samples. But there have been one or two times where we've had to leave it sitting around and slowly go through it over a couple of months of tours and everything else to get through it, because we don't sell it. And that's our biggest problem. Is, you know, if you can sell it, it's easy to get rid of it.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the stage, is to really figure out if we can get a brewer, you know, actually, I don't know if we'd be able to sell a selling license. We could have it in our gift shop here, something that's very unique, because the Ale Through the Ages program that I've been running for the last 4 years, you know, we're brewing maybe about 15, sometimes 20 gallons, but every participant who comes gets, we basically share it as a group, as an organ, as a class. So, and the classes are on order between 30 and 70 people, so, you know, it may be a couple beers apiece, it could be more than that. For the Master Brewer class, you know, people are signing up a little bit higher price tag, but they're, you know, getting that experience brewing with the head brewer from a professional company, brewing company. But then they walk away with a case of that. So that's sort of up front. We basically are sharing everything out of the system. So they're paying for the class, and they walk away with the finished product, is the idea.
So I assume that you get a kind of a different makeup of demographics in these classes. I assume that in the master classes you probably get experienced home brewers, and in the other classes you get kind of newbies?
Yeah, I think the Ale Through the Ages is sort of the introduction course. There's no restrictions to be a master brewer, like in the master brewer class. That's really a title ascribed to the head brewers, the master brewers from those breweries, imparting their knowledge to the public. And yes, most of those participants have extensive backgrounds in brewing, but there are occasionally a couple people that are really interested, are beer enthusiasts, but are not brewers per se yet.
Yeah, but they want that experience of working on professional equipment and working with, even sometimes it's not even, they don't care as much working with that brewer. They want the chance to say, you know, I was standing next to this man as he, or this woman as they were creating this beer. And yeah, the last class we had three of them, I think. Three out of the 16 had never brewed before, and just came because they thought it sounded like a good experience.
So they get hands-on. I guess with the larger classes, it's difficult, more difficult for everybody to get their hands on the equipment, or to get their hands in the grain, or, you know, in the mash or whatever. But
yeah.
I assume that you want to give them as much of a hands-on experience as possible.
That's the idea. Certainly the tasting experience obviously comes in the end, but really the hands-on comes with the bottling session. So in the brewing for the Ale Through the Ages, it's in a theater capacity space. So we have the brewing set up, you know, the top tier system, the gravity. But we have people come up and put in ingredients throughout the boil, and then help with, you know, the actual moving of the wort afterwards, cooling it down, and then ultimately when it sits for that 2-week, 3-week window, during fermentation, then they come back as a class, and then they're all bottling, they're all taking part in the process of putting that resulting beer into bottles or mead or whatever it might be. So that's really where they get the hands-on experience and then get to sit with it for and let it age as long as they want, depending on the recipe. So yeah, that's been a really fun experience, and just to see this kind of core of enthusiasts building in this region. I mean, there's people coming, driving a couple of hundred miles sometimes just for these classes, which is pretty exciting, you know, all the way from Madison to come here, La Crosse. It's around the state, some from Illinois across the border. So it's definitely one of those unique spaces that the Thirst Lab to have that gives the public that opportunity to work with professional equipment, but also professionals, and step their game up a notch, but then get a flavor that they probably would never be able to buy anywhere on the shelf, especially if you're dealing with the 2,500-year-old Braggot or a mead that's just as old or something completely different. So,
yeah, you are an archaeologist. How do you sort of dig up these recipes, or how do you research these recipes?
Yeah, I guess, well, part of it, there are some kind of esoteric journals out there that some scholars in the past, let's say 50 years, have been doing some work on this, and it's really the field of archaeometry, so the chemistry of archaeology, and that's where, after, particularly they're found in burial contexts, so we're really looking at mortuary records around the world where a field excavation has taken place. For instance, in China, the oldest alcoholic beverage known comes from the Henan province of China and at the site of Jiahu. And so it was Patrick McGovern, really, who is a pioneer in this field of ancient fermented beverages. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. And you may be familiar with Dogfish Head and their collaboration. So Patrick McGovern's research informs a lot of the work that I do, and I kind of am using a lot of that information to then extrapolate what those ingredients are best suited to be here, to be able to brew that. So there's some of that that's out in the published material. The most recent one was really research that was done by my advisor at UW-Milwaukee, Tina Arnold, and her colleagues in Germany. And so when we recreated this Hochdorf mead, this mead of Hochdorf, which is a burial in Baden-Württemberg in southwestern Germany, it was actually analysis from that burial tomb that her colleagues had done. And so we, you know, from that, this palynological research, that means looking at the pollen found in some of these residues. So it's residue analysis that's been done over the past couple of decades, and more recently, to then extrapolate, well, what ingredients were growing then, what are ingredients can be best suited to mimic that flavor if it's not an absolute match. But then the wild card is always the yeast and what yeast strains you can get today on the market, or if you try to create your own. For instance, we did an Egyptian beer over the winter, and we used the wild yeast found on the dates. The dates came from Tunisia, and so part of it is sort of explaining how, you know, the yeast, you know, that's floating around in Tunisia is probably similar in terms of a species than would have been around during the Egyptian times. Now, of course, it modifies, but it's generally speaking Saccharomyces cerevisiae, with some modifications of probably Brettanomyces and some other wild-born yeast. So, so I like to use various yeasts as well to sort of show the public about how yeast will affect flavor and fermentation. And so I like to use two different types in each batch that we do. So you get two different flavors based on those yeast strains. So it's a lot of research. It's a lot of, you know, diving into old textbooks and published papers that are out there, as well as, you know, on the ground kind of intuition as a brewer, but then also you know, as an archaeologist, to kind of figure out what would be appropriate for the time and the equipment that would have been used.
So do you actually split the batch and pitch one yeast in one side and the other yeast in the other?
Yeah, that's correct. So for the Ale Through the Ages, for that we'll do typically 2 6-gallon carboys. One will be one type of yeast and one the other, depending again on what it is. So, for instance, with the last one we did with the mead of Hochdorf, we used the standard, you know, mead yeast in one. But then we're using, you know, Y yeast, for instance. Some of them actually I've propagated from previous batches of other types. We did an Anatolian ale, which was a burial in Turkey, and in that burial they found a king very similar to Germany. And so we used yeast for that, and I used that again. And so there's some sort of interesting elements that have been brought forth in that yeast palette. So yeah, there's lots of different ways to kind of explain what, you know, what the resulting product would be, but then how effective that yeast is. So it's still one of those things we want to do is to do more classes specifically on yeast and yeast culturing and streak plates and all of that. So because that really is, you're getting into the really the secret recipe there, the secret ingredients in the end product.
So talk about the mead recipe. What was it like?
It was quite delicious. In fact, I used, based on, the pollen research that came out of the residue of this, there's this cauldron, for instance. Right? Okay, it was 2,600 years ago, buried with this king in Hochdorf, and the cauldron could hold up to about 500 liters of mead, which turned out, because they found in the desiccated remains this chunk, this big, thick deposit on the bottom of this cauldron, this bronze cauldron. That was essentially the ceremonial feast of this chieftain, this Celtic chieftain. And these are continental Celts. They eventually spread into Ireland. So 2,600 years ago, in that analysis of the residue, it was determined that there was at least 60 different plant species that would have been theirs, or pollen types. Now, the pollen was likely from the bees that collected the flowers of those plants. So to say 60 different plants went into that mead is probably not true. It's probably more like the flavors of 60 different flowering types of plants was a result of the mead or the honey that was collected and then ultimately fermented. So the two primary ingredients, the ones that would have overwhelmingly been the statistically overwhelmingly present was thyme, wild thyme flowers, and also meadow sweets. And meadow sweets often found throughout the world in various forms, in various alcoholic beverages across continental Europe and beyond. So meadow sweet and thyme were then added. We used the leaves of that, but with honey that was actually locally grown or locally collected wild honey. So we didn't get German honey, unfortunately, but we found honey that was locally collected here, and that was from the Urban Apiculture Institute, which is a local organization that actually does urban beekeeping. So they donated a lot of honey, and so for that we used 30 pounds of honey. For a 12-gallon batch, it was 30 pounds of wildflower honey. We added a little bit of barley based on the residue analysis, a little bit of Weyermann smoked malt, and so that it's not quite a braggot at that stage. It's only a minor amount, so it's about 3 pounds of that. And then thyme and meadow sweet were added very late in the it wasn't even boiled. We didn't need to get it up to boiling. Likely these meads were not boiled. In fact, they're antibacterial to begin with in honey. So we just got it up just below boiling and then added the thyme and the meadow sweets late in that process. So the result is really, and fermented, of course, then with, as I mentioned, a mead yeast in one 6-gallon batch and then a lambic yeast in another to bring out some of that kind of Brettanomyces wild kind of yeast flavors. The result is a delicious, flowery, kind of earthy mead, very sweet. We kind of left it. It was a short fermentation period, so I'd like to have left it longer. But given the class turnaround, they come back 2 to 3 weeks later. So ideally, in the mead, you want to let it age for a good, you know, several months. So.
Yeah, what kind of character? I imagine I could predict what you would get from the sweet mead, but what did the lambic yeast do for the mead?
Yeah, it gave it obviously it wasn't quite sour, pie, cherry kind of flavor, but I think it pronounced, you know, some of the, you know, wild lambic flavors you get out of Belgium. So, I mean, it is slightly tart, but you're also getting some of the thyme itself gives it that really that kind of floral, herbal sort of flavor. So that, I think, was the dominant palate, but then you get the subtleties of the lambic that's definitely different from the champagne or the mead yeast. So a little bit more funk, let's say, in the lambic and something a bit more sweet and dry in the mead yeast.
Do you think the flavors in the lambic will continue to evolve over time?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. That's one of the things we like to monitor, too, and keep track of that. Everybody walks away with a couple of those apiece, and so they get to try them. But yeah, hopefully, you know, it'll change, and beverages that will age for a year or two or more. So the other mead we did, this was about 2 years ago, it was mead of Meath, Meath and County Meath in Ireland. I grew up in Ireland. I moved over here really for high school and college. But so it was fun. I was actually back in Ireland that just that winter. It was 2009. And so I was in County Meath in Tara. The Hill of Tara is where the ancient kings of Ireland were basically crowned, and it's a very ancient landscape. But they have evidence on that landscape at Tara of this mead hall. It's called the Tech Mead Cairte, which is a big long, what's left today anyway, it's like a big long trench and with berms on either side that would have opened up to a large, you know, roof over the top. In any case, in that on that site, they have found obviously historic written documentation about mead being consumed in this mead hall. Of course, it's very similar to like Beowulf and some of these early later written texts. So the mead of Meath was kind of more of a traditional sort of standard ale or standard mead with, in terms of the honey itself. It was wild flower honey collected again in Wisconsin. It's hard to get Irish honey. But in any case, we ended up fermenting it with a couple of different yeast strains as well. It was one was an ale, or an Irish, just for the giving tip of the hat to Ireland, but an Irish ale yeast, which did quite well on it, and then a mead yeast as well. But adding a little bit of peat smoked barley, that peat smoke, I'm sure they probably were adding various types of malt as well into it to become kind of like a braggot. And so that's 2 years aged, and it's fantastic. The braggot actually is very interesting. When we did, it was Bronze Age braggot, and that was December of just last year, 2011. And braggots, for those out there who don't know, it's obviously a combination of really a fermented, a malted beverage with honey added throughout the process. So in this case, this is a legitimate archaeological recipe based on, again, residue analysis found in a birch bucket found in a burial of a young lady, actually, in Denmark. And it dates to the Bronze Age, which is about 1500 to 1300 BCE. So we're talking, you know, 3,500 years ago. And bog myrtle was one of the things that we added to this. Bog myrtle is sort of like, it's Marcia Gale or Sweet Gale. You can sometimes get that in homebrew supply shops. Meadow Sweet was also found in the residue. Meadow Sweet, again, is kind of found cross-culturally in many fermented beverages. And then the interesting part was it was also cranberries and lingonberries were found in this beverage. So it was, the recipe for that really involved Weihermann, so a dark wheat malt with some standard malted barley, and then clover honey. So it was almost a half and half recipe of honey to barley, and then boil additions were the bog myrtle and then meadow sweet, and then cranberries and lingonberries were added as well, just late in the boil and then in secondary. So that's a very interesting kind of a tart, unique flavor of a concoction of a braggot, which is fun to kind of play around with those ancient recipes as well and see how they turn out.
Wow. And now you've done, you say you've done around 25 different ancient and historic recipes?
Yeah, so I have to go back. It's on my blog, actually, the Distant Mirror Archaeology blog. It's www.distantmirror, as in looking into the past. That's where the idea of a reflection of yourself is the mirror. So the distantmirror.discoveryworld.org. In fact, all of these recipes and research and content is online, so you can download that and check out some of the other things we're doing with brewing history tours as well. So yeah, I could go into many, many different recipes and how we come up with them. But ideally, it's extreme brewing. It's opening up new flavor palettes and getting people to sort of realize that there's many ingredients out there that you have been brewed throughout antiquity. And Reinheitsgebot is, you know, as great as it is, certainly limited the and probably for good reason in its time, why they were putting restrictions on what you could put in beer. But it certainly has affected our current certain amount of types of beers that are with us today. Now, you know, home brewing and craft brewing industries are sort of reinvestigating those earlier flavors. So this is just one element of that as well in terms of the archaeology.
We like to say that Reinheitsgebot is a four-letter word.
Yeah.
do you have you looked into some of the earlier American recipes as well?
Yeah, a little bit. We did a colonial porter using kind of treacle and some various dark roasted malts. And yeah, so there's early colonial period. That's what we're going to start really investigating this autumn, this next brewing season. That the Ale Through the Ages classes run between October and March. And I'd like to definitely do that and maybe look into George Washington's recipe that's known, that's out there. So it's really, you know, informing, because part of this is the presentation element is really getting, looking at not only the beer and how it's brewed, but the context in which it was brewed and the archaeological context or the historical context. And I think that's what a lot of people find really fascinating and interesting is to see what life was like back then, what they were drinking, but also a little bit about, you know, how they arrived at the recipes that they did, and then the archaeology that we can see in the excavated material, and how research around the world has come to those conclusions. So whether it's in Sumeria or all the way to Philadelphia, it's kind of fascinating and to go on a global trek spatially and temporally through our taste buds.
And for the history of fermented beverages, is it pretty much universal around the world? I mean, are all parts of the world brewers in some way?
Absolutely, really, and that's the great kind of adage is beer was not, you know, invented; it was discovered, and it's a natural process. I mean, yeast is wild; it's been around way before humans stepped foot on the earth. So, you know, when it comes to it, it really actually probably needs type. Wines, if that's really what they are some of the first alcoholic beverages, because there's the Paleolithic hypothesis. This is one of those ideas that obviously a wild colony of bees have a hive in a tree, and the tree gets struck by lightning, and it rains, and then all of a sudden that hive is exposed. The honey is exposed at a certain dilution factor of about 30%. That honey will start fermenting naturally by itself. So it's just a matter of time that an animal or a human would have stumbled across that and consumed it, and voila, you know, we have the savanna of parts of Africa. I'm sure people were exploring, you know, various fermented fruits across the world as well. And so no matter where you look, it's really the archaeological record, you know, in terms of fermented barleys and things like that, were, you know, calcium oxalate is the smoking gun. It's beer stone. It's still with us today in breweries, and you do it at home brewing. In your hoses, you can kind of get that buildup. But that's where you look in the archaeological record in terms of finding in these pottery vessels or even bronze vessels, you might actually still see that. That will indicate some form of grain fermentation. But yes, it's cross-cultural. It doesn't have to be barley. It depends on where you were. In Mesoamerica, it was chicha or various types of corn, fermented corn beverages that were consumed by the Mayans and before, you know, in South America by pre-Incan cultures as well. And there's archaeological evidence of that. So again, I mean, if you're in Africa, it's millet-type beers. Or in the Himalayas, I was fortunate to live a year in India and see various types of fermented beverages there. They have a thing called toddy, which is fermented coconut milk up in the trees in the canopy. They ferment it up there in these ceramic vessels, and it's kind of a lower grade, lower alcoholic volume. But needless to say, that's certainly ancient. I don't know how much research has been done in terms of the archaeology of toddy. The same goes for up in the Himalayas. I was up there trekking, and they drink something called tomba or chang. It's just fermented millet, and it's warm. You add warm water to this millet, and you drink out of a bamboo straw, and it's a mild alcoholic beverage, but full of nutrients. So, again, I mean, it's cross-cultural, and it's why it's still with us today.
And I imagine you could use these recipes as you find them as kind of indicators of kind of a timeline of when cultures met each other and shared ingredients and recipes across cultural lines. And, you know, it's kind of sparks my imagination that you could see, like, for instance, the use of hops, you know, where those originated and how that came across time. And I would imagine there would be other ingredients that you could kind of trace through time and across space through history as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And you know, with in terms of just barley and then malted barleys or wheat, for instance, there's different types. Of course, the 2-row and the 6-row in terms of the barley. But what even vessel shapes as well. And then how, for instance, the bell beaker culture in Europe spread from sort of east to west. And so when that's introduced into the Celtic Isles or the British Isles, that's an indication too of migrations of people and bringing not only what they were fermenting but also the methods by which they were doing it and then all the other trappings of their culture at that time, whether it be language but also other tools of domestication of grain or animals, animal husbandry and all of that. So in Mesopotamia you get the clay tablets that actually give you cuneiform ancient writing about the recipes, but also the commodities which were traded. You brought up hops. I mean, hops being really only an addition to beer within the last, 1,000 or so years, maybe 1,500 at the most, coming out of Scandinavia and moving south into Europe and beyond. So, they are a very kind of their indicator ingredients if you know what you're looking for and you're doing proper analysis, and it really takes kind of a chemistry background but an archaeological inquisitiveness I think too to tease these elements apart. So I think we're just on the cutting edge of that, and I think hopefully the Thirst Lab here in Milwaukee can kind of help articulate some of that certainly, and then give the general public who have no background in archaeology or chemistry at least an insight into kind of the diversity of fermented beverages, but also an appreciation really for where they come from and many, many diverse flavors throughout the world. So
it's important stuff.
I would say so. I mean, if you can't tell already, I'm a pretty big beer geek, but more so an archaeological geek too, which combining the two is a fun endeavor.
Well, this has been fascinating, and I could go on even without sipping a beer. I could go on talking about this for a while longer, but you guys have been very generous with your time, and I hope that that would make a fun field trip to go up there and take part in one of those classes.
Definitely, yeah. Check out the website, this distantmirror.discoveryworld.org. Otherwise, there's these historic brewery tours too. It's not just about what was fermented around the world, but right in their own backyard. And Milwaukee has been home to over 120 breweries over the last 130 or 175 years, and there's many more on the horizon as we speak. So finding where the roots are, I think, connects us to not only the past of our city, but the future of the economy of the craft beer industry, which is fortunately gaining stronger and stronger momentum.
Yeah, we're on an important time in history. I would say the craft beer is exploding, and I think that it's just yet another chapter opening up on the whole story.
Yeah, it's true, and we're realizing that it's actually there's antecedents, there's a precedent in the 1860s. When they were at least in this town anyway over 2 dozen, 3 dozen breweries operating at the same time. So we're kind of getting back to our roots, as it were, in terms of 19th century small craft beer in locally brewed towns for an appreciative population. So we've come out of the Prohibition era and the macro industry, and now we're sort of entering again, like you said, that new chapter, but a rebirth anyway of our 19th century American brewing history.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad that Michael Henderson, our listener, sent me an email talking about his experience. He was really excited about it. So I hope that we can show some more people toward your direction then. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Paul.
Cheers. All right.
Thanks again to Kevin and Paul. I would love to attend one of those brewing sessions. It sounds like a lot of fun. And I'm going to check out the recipes on Kevin's blog to see if I can brew one of those here. And also thanks to Michael Henderson for letting me know about the Discovery World program. Very, very cool. If you have brewing questions or show suggestions or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site along with our Brewer's Logbook, which is now available to order. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our basic brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are set of three Praying Mantis egg cases and 16-ounce ragtop vinyl protectant. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next week, everybody. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.